All right, talk about that later if you want. All right, so our subject is tech protection, but I noticed while I was browsing the web that something that might interest any of you who's planning to do a paper on open source, and that's that the Practical Law Company, a provider of practical legal know-how to law firms, law departments, and law schools, will host a free webinar, Open Source Software Risks, Use, and Compliance, and that's February 22nd. So if anyone is sufficiently interested, you can look at after class, you can copy the relevant information from my machine and go look at it and see whether it's interesting. I don't know if it is or not, but I thought it could be. We really have two subjects. The one which is in the book and which I've discussed in the past is technological protection and associated with that general issue of the death of copyright. And then the other one, which is new and I've just got thoughts on, is social media broadly defined. I'm really thinking more generally of how not only Facebook, but also Usenet and Twitter and all of the fast, easy ways of communication we now have, how they affect both things like national political campaigns, but also things like insurrections as have been happening in the Arab world and so forth. And I have some ideas about that, but we'll be interested in hearing your ideas as well. So let's start on the question of tech protection. And the question is, did things occur to you reading the chapter or thinking about the issue that you'd like to talk about? Nobody has any reactions on tech protection.
Just a little uncertain on how digital watermarks would actually work.
Yeah, the part of it I'm not sure I believe is the claim I've seen that you can have a digital watermark, which if you print out the picture, scan it back in, survives. And I'm not sure I know how I see how that can be done, although that's claimed. But short of that, if you think about how you hide messages in pictures, all right, I think I discussed as one of the things you could do if you wanted to have private communications. If you take a picture where each pixel is represented by 3 8-bit numbers for 3 different colors, changing the least significant bit of one of those colors is not going to visibly change the appearance. That's, 2, 4, 8, 6? That's changing by about 1% the intensity of red, say, in that picture. But if you knew that the red bit of every pixel read in some particular sequence contained information, that information could be the name of the copyright holder, his contact information, and so forth. So that would be I don't know the technology they're actually using, but that would be an example of a simple way in which you could do it. And you could think of fancier ways. You could have it that it's not just a message in those bits, that from those bits you calculate, sum the least significant digit of each of the 3 colors in the pixel, and that, and if that sum is even, it means one thing and odd another. You can think of lots of ways in which you could make very, very small changes in a digital image, such that those changes had a pattern that contained information. And what would be very hard to do, I think, is to have such a system, make the tools for reading the information public, and yet prevent people from taking the message out. Because if you have the tools for reading it, you would think you could reverse engineer them and figure out what they're doing. Now, there are a lot of clever people in the world, so maybe there are solutions to such problems, but it's not clear how. But you could see that if you did your embedding in some way which only you could read, so to speak, so that that is part of the point I make in the discussion, which I think is right. And again, as you can probably tell, parts of that chapter are me sort of speculating about stuff I've heard about. It's not like I'm really an expert on the current technology on it, and also it was written a few years ago. But that you could certainly imagine a system where you've got a double watermark. There's one watermark using some well-known public system such as what I've described, and that one is what people use when they want to obey copyright law. And so I find an image, I'd like to use it, got to know who it belongs to, read off the watermark, and email the owner. And I've been in that situation without watermarks. That is, you find Google has got this huge database of images, and you search for images on some particular thing, and you find one you like, and it's got some information along with it, you get in touch. So that my second novel, when I put it up as a Kindle, it needed a cover. And that's a little odd because it doesn't physically exist. But Amazon wants a cover picture to go with the entry for that thing when people are buying it. So the title of the novel was Salamander. The salamander in question was the fire elemental, the idea you get in some fantasy stories of a being who somehow is the essence of fire. And so I searched for fire elemental salamanders online, and I found this beautiful quilt that somebody had done. She had done quilts of the four elementals, the earth, air, fire, and water elementals. And the salamander one was really pretty. So I emailed her, and I said, do you mind if I use your quilt as my cover picture? And she said, it's fine as long as you credit me. And so, you know, at the beginning of the thing, I credit whose quilt it is, and I used that. And I thought that was really neat in terms of sort of using the digital tools to find it, and then a kind of a sort of a gift economy sharing interaction for doing it. Along somewhat similar lines, my first novel, I wanted to find a map. I wanted somebody to draw a map. And so I don't remember where I put the query, but it got through to somebody who was a professional artist and who had always wanted to do something like the maps that go with Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And apparently she also was familiar with my nonfiction writing and liked it. So I made a deal and I sent her one copy of each of my books, and she drew a really gorgeous, much better than I could possibly have done for myself, map to go with the novel. Now, unfortunately, the novel was printed in black and white, so the full version of the map only exists online, but the web page for the book has got a link to that map. So all of that is sort of interesting, just to sort of my own little bit of wading, as it were, in the waters of new ways of doing things enabled by these technologies. Other comments? Questions? Yeah.
In the book, you talked about a service in which you could have much of the data be on the user side, and then the critical part is that the server
yes.
pay for access.
Right.
And it occurred to me that's exactly what Apple does in theory, because everything is, all the software here does all the recognition, and then it's set, maybe some of it goes to Apple, but whatever. The whole idea is that you have to have the right phone, the 4S or above, to give that functionality. And a lot of hackers try to mimic that, for us, has an older one, and it's really difficult to do it. And even if they do that, just, switch it up and the next update. So, that's the implementation.
The implementation that occurred to me, that is, let's go back to what the problem is. The problem is you would lie, the creator of the intellectual property wants to be able to control it to make money out of it. Maybe for other reasons, but mostly, most often to make money out of it. And one way of doing that, since once he lets you download it, you got it in your hot little hands and it's sort of hard to keep you from making copies of it, is to say, the critical parts sit on my server, assuming that I do a good job of computer security, nobody can get at those, and then we just interact with you. And one problem with that is that the more stuff is happening on the server, first, the more the server is tied up, and the more information has to move back and forth, which could be a time lag. And the sort of elegant solution to that is that you have most of what's happening happen on the client, on your machine, and just enough happen on the server so it won't work without it. And I thought of a much bigger example than yours, namely World of Warcraft. I don't know how many of you have ever played World of Warcraft, but one of the weird things that sometimes happens when things go wrong is you're still in the program, but you've lost your connection. And you can keep on moving around. You can wander around through this world, but it's a ghost world. There's nobody there. And pretty clearly what's going on is that the full description of the World of Warcraft world is on your machine. You've downloaded it at some stage. And they keep updating it when they update the program. But your machine can't possibly have the information of where other players are, because that depends on their input. So your machine is telling the server what your character is doing. His machine is telling the server what his character is doing. The server is telling my machine what his character is doing, and vice versa, the other direction. So that's a fairly striking case of just that. Now, it's also a case of sort of a different point I make, namely that the difference between World of Warcraft and a movie is that a movie is fully revealed on one use and World of Warcraft isn't, and therefore it doesn't do any good to copy it, as it were. But those all seem to me to be examples. Other points, comments. All right, now, the problem, as usual, is that most of what I have to say on this subject you've already read. So let me run through things quickly, and why don't you stop me at any point where you think things are worth discussing, you have something to add, or it's unclear. And we start out with the problem that I think of as the death of copyright. And the basic issue is that the enforceability of copyright law depends on technology. That the famous example is that circa 1900, the U.S. did not protect British copyrights in books. Nonetheless, British authors made royalty from their U.S. sales because given the printing technology at the time, which was handset lead type, there was a big first mover advantage. So if the authorized publisher had his books printed up at the point when the British copy came out, which is the point at which the pirate could start, he had a big advantage in the initial sales, which tend to be a lot of the sales of a new book, and thus was able in practice to pay royalty. And the exact reverse of that is the current situation with music, where indeed the law gives the copyright owner the right to forbid copying, but it doesn't give him the ability to forbid copying. And one solution to that is you say, well, all right, some violators can't be detected, just forget about them, but we'll enforce against the ones that are easy to detect, such as firms using our software who haven't paid copyright. Similarly, you can say, yes, but the customers really want not just a song, but whichever song they'd like to listen to at the moment, and probably no friend has that song, and therefore the convenience of having online distribution makes them willing to pay, but that then starts breaking down as the illegal online distribution gets better and better, and we saw that run through around with the music a few years ago. On the other hand, a critical point here and in many other contexts is that you don't have to make what you're objecting to impossible, you just have to make it unprofitable. That I have a very small collection of economics jokes, and one of them, by which I mean jokes that teach economics, not jokes about economics, and one of them was contributed by the editor for my price theory textbook, and that's the story of the economist and the businessman who are walking in the woods when they encounter a large and angry bear. And the economist turns to run, and the businessman says, ah, you impractical sorts. You think you can outrun the bear? No, but I might outrun you. And the point, of course, is that you don't have to make it impossible for the bear to eat you. You only have to make it unprofitable, which in this case means there's somebody else that's easier for him to eat. And that point then came up in that textbook, actually, in what's been a hot political issue in recent years, namely concealed carry of handguns. Because one argument against the idea that you could reduce crime by allowing ordinary citizens to carry guns was, but the criminal is much more experienced in the use of violence than the random citizen, so if there's a gunfight between the criminal and the citizen, the criminal will usually win. And the answer is, well, yes, that's true. What percentage of the gunfights does the criminal have to lose before he chooses to find a safer way of making a living? And not a very high percentage, right? So that's, again, a case where the way to think of the problem is not how do you make mugging people impossible, not even how do you make it usually lose, just how do you make it lose on average. And my favorite example of that is actually a science fiction story. Are any of you Poole Anderson fans? He was a fairly, not alive anymore, but he was quite a good one of the early science fiction writers. And he's got a story called Margin of Profit, which is an economic story. And the story is one in which the protagonist is the head of Solar Spice and Liquors, which is a large interstellar trading firm. And there is a trade route between two groups of stars, and sitting in the middle of it is a small and very unpleasant empire, and very unscrupulous empire. Think of them as Somali pirates. And they've got a policy, and their policy is that when a ship comes by, they seize it. They brainwash the crew and recruit it into their navy, and they seize the ship and arm it and recruit it into their navy too. And the question is, what's to be done? And it's a small empire, and the trading corporations put together have more resources than it does, and they could build a fleet and fight a war and defeat it, but that's very expensive. Indeed, a war of that sort would cost much more than all of the profits they'll ever make on the trading route. So they're not going to do that. And so they could arm all of their trading ships, but using a warship instead of a freighter makes it much more expensive, needs a bigger crew, that'll wipe out the profits on the trade route. And so Von Rien first gets the heads of the other companies to agree that they will pay a bonus to whoever solves the problem. And his solution is to arm one ship in four. Because the enemy warships have much larger crews than the ordinary merchant ships. Three times out of four, the attacking warship captures the trading ship, seizes its four-man crew, and brainwashes them. One time out of four, the trading ship that's really a warship seizes the attacking warship, liberates its 20-man crew. On average, the Empire is losing, not winning, and the result is that after a while, as I think Von Rien says, and not being stupid heads, they will stop, and then maybe we can do business with them. So it's quite a neat story. I thought it would be fun to put together a book of works of fiction that teach economics, but unfortunately, I only have a couple of candidates, and so not enough for a book yet. But that would be one of them. Another one is the poem by Kipling, but that's another story. In all of these things, you sort of can work it through as a pure logic, but that doesn't really tell you whether, as a practical matter, methods that don't work might still work well enough so that most people would rather pay a modest price than go to the trouble of evading them. And the other solution, another solution, of course, is to find ways other than copyright law of getting paid for producing intellectual property. And one of them, which is a very intriguing one, but pretty hard, which the chapter is partly about, is technological protection. To find some way of making available your intellectual property that doesn't make it possible to copy it. And that's been a challenge for a long time, that early on they had floppy disks, back when floppy disks were really floppy, which was a couple of generations ago, which were designed not to be copyable. But then, of course, other people brought out programs designed to copy the non-copyable disks. And my favorite story there was, what was it called? There was a program called Super Utility Plus, I think. I think this was on the Tristos, the early Radio Shack computers. And Super Utility Plus did all sorts of useful things, including copying other people's copy-protected disks. It was, of course, copy-protected against itself. So somebody else brought out a program called Super Duper, whose sole purpose in life was to copy Super Utility Plus disks, which seemed only fair under the circumstances. And there was, as you may know, some litigation, and at that point the court conclusion was that it was not illegal to produce such software. The DMCA has reversed that result eventually, but that was the case then. But then there are various fancier versions, and I discuss in the chapter the idea of a cryptolope, or other people had other terms, but basically distributing your song in a computer program which will only play the song for you if you pay it money. And that requires some way it can know that you paid it money, which could be nowadays everyone's online, so you make a payment online, and that sends the signal to your program saying play a song. And then, as I discussed, the basic problem with that is the analog hole. The basic problem is that I can play the song once, record it, and redigitize it, and I now got it outside of the program. And again, maybe that's enough trouble so I won't bother, but at least it means that it can't be a watertight solution, as it were, to the problem. And you can try to do what they do try to do with DVDs, to say, well, we will make this so we'll only play on a player that has got our secret information embedded in it, and we'll only let you embed our secret information if you promise to make a player that will make copies. But again, I could have a recorder. I've got physical possession of that player, so I can presumably go into it and change where the signals are going, and given reasonable ingenuity, what actually happened, I can look at it, examine it, reverse engineer the protective software, and then publish it and get sued for doing so, and everybody else can then make software on their machines which will play that DVD. So it's not a very good solution, and the kludge that the people who wanted protector came up with, again, is the DMCA. The kludge would say, look, the ordinary user can't do all this stuff. We don't care if one guy in 100,000 can pirate our stuff, as long as he can't pass the word on to anybody else. So the theory is that it's now illegal to tell people how to break the encryption. It's illegal to distribute software that breaks the encryption, but whatever the protective software is and so forth. And that was an attempt, but I'm skeptical that that's going to hold on for very long. Yeah.
So, I think 2 years ago, the U.S. I just remember that the decision that jailbreaking was not a violation.
Yes.
And so the copyright, the U.S. Copyright Office actually made an exemption in the DMCA that allowed for that, and that's it's not a permanent exemption, but that is essentially.
But it's circumventing it in a way that the courts decided was legal. That is circumventing a kind of protection that the courts decided was not covered. Was not covered by it. I think. Yeah. I don't know why. I don't know the case. But
well, I mean, I think it makes sense for them to do that. Otherwise, if the entire DMCA was going to be challenged, I mean, it didn't make an exception that the whole DMCA could be challenged, right?
Well, the whole DMCA could be challenged. Question whether the court would uphold it.
Right, but this would be, the court made a decision that you can jailbreak, and so the DMCA doesn't make a jailbreak, and that's challenging the DMCA.
Yes.
Make an exception, the DMCA right. Survive while they,
So, so then a somewhat better version of this is the one we were discussing a few minutes ago of the client-server solution, where you say, I'm not going to put it in your hands. You're never going to get your filthy fingers on my code. My code is running in my very well-protected server, and what I will give you the stuff that I'm not protecting. And then part of the trick there, as we were saying a moment ago, is that you can make that whole system work much better if the client computer is doing most of the work, because now when you double the number of customers, you double the amount of hardware that's processing the information, and only some crucial pieces of the work are being done online by the server. All right, makes sense. Yeah?
That's how Warner Brothers and other studios have the ultraviolet copy of the movie, so you buy a DVD, it comes with...
I don't know, what's the ultraviolet copy?
It's that, essentially. They used to do digital downloads where you just download to your computer, but then those...
get copied,
So now it's... you basically get an account, and it links all your purchases to that same account. You can access it from anywhere on your computer. Basically, it's stored in the cloud, but you don't actually own it, you just access it.
But do they have to download it to you each time you watch it?
No, it streams, so it doesn't download. It's not your copy, they just show it to you.
But they have to transmit it over the internet for you to watch it.
Yes, similar to the way Netflix shows.
As opposed to a system where you could imagine a version of this. Assume it may not be a good version given that video takes up a lot of space, but if you're dealing with something that doesn't take up too much space, you would like a version where they download it to you once, 96% of it, and that way only 4% has to come down, which would make it much easier if you don't have a good connection or something in order to play it.
But then that only lets you use it on one device, not cross.
That's right. That's true. That's perfectly true. Yeah. No, I think what's the game company which has something like this? There's a very popular...
Steam,
right. Steam has got a similar kind of system for computer games where you can do it on any machines. Yeah. And really the book was written before cloud computing had become a live issue, and if I ever do an update, I suppose I would have to try to think about how that affects all of it. But of course, you still have the analog hole problem when you're doing it that way. So because in your case, in your ultraviolet thing, in principle, if I really want to pirate the film, I can still pirate it because I will download it once. But instead of feeding the information to my screen or while feeding the information to my screen, I will have done stuff with my computer which allows me to record what's going to the screen, and now I've got a recording of the movie. So what?
That's actually really easy to do.
Is it easy? Yeah. But so in that sense, it's not a very satisfactory solution. But it is a satisfactory solution for World of Warcraft or Lexis or Westlaw or a computer program. All right, you could if what you're worried about having pirated is Microsoft Word, well, you divide Word into two parts, and 4% of it sits on the server, and 96% is downloaded for free to the customer. And in order to use it, he's got to be paying you 10 cents an hour for the connection to your server, which is what is sending just enough information to make the rest of it work. And that would be one viable solution, as far as I can tell, to the whole problem, as long as there isn't a disloyal employee or somebody who lets out the 4% and then it spreads. And then you update the program. But that's an interesting. So it does seem to be one point that I haven't seen discussed very much, and I mean I came up with it myself, and probably some other people have, is this distinction between intellectual property that is or isn't revealed in use. That anything that's fully revealed in use runs into the analog hole problem, and you know, maybe you can make it a little inconvenient, but you can't really protect it. Whereas something that isn't, in principle, you can have watertight protection as long as you do a good enough job of keeping your server from getting accessed by people who shouldn't.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. What you were saying about the streaming, so because I don't know technology, were you saying that you can still copy off the stream?
There's a program you can run that captures everything that happens on your computer. So whether you're moving them, like, to make instructional videos, you're moving the mouse around, it makes a video of that.
Okay.
Just running video and recording it.
Is the quality that you get?
Probably not as good.
Okay.
Well, but the quality is limited to your screen by your screen anyway.
Yeah.
So presumably you ought to be able to record as good quality as your screen shows, because that's what the quality is that's going to the screen.
But then you can necessarily blow it up to a bigger screen later.
But if you wanted to pirate it, you would of course do the original downloading for the biggest screen anybody was likely to use. I would do it to my 24-inch iMac, and then you're good enough for practical. Now there might still be problems because presumably when you stream it, does it know how big your screen is?
I've never used it.
Because it might be that what they do is that your computer tells it the screen size and what streams down then depends on that size. And even if I've got a version for 24-inch, shrinking it to 21-inch and still looking good is not a trivial problem, right? You can do it, but you're going to lose some resolution because, you know, you can't turn 5 pixels into 4 pixels, so to speak. So that might be, for all I know, that might be part of how they do it. That would make it a little less convenient. If you really wanted to do the pirating, you'd have to pirate 5 different versions for 5 different screen sizes and then try to make them available. So we discussed watermarking, and I talked in there a bit about fingerprinting, which is sort of intriguing because that's sort of watermarking from the other end. That's where what you're identifying is not the pirate, but the person who gave it to the pirate, right? You're saying, look, in order for you to get a copy of my program, somebody I sold the program to has to have given it to you. When I sell it, I mark it in a way that identifies who bought this particular copy. I then have a contraction. He agrees in my contract that he won't make copies, which he's not supposed to anyway. It's a violation of copyright law. In fact, that's interesting. Suppose there were no special contracts. Suppose I fingerprint a piece of something covered by copyright law. I register the copyright. I sell it to you. You allow him to make copies. And he makes lots and lots of copies. You violated copyright law because you permitted him to copy it. And I am entitled to sue you for actual damages. And the actual damages are the damages due to all of his copies. So I think that's right. But I think in principle I wouldn't even have to have a special contract by which you agreed to be liable. I think I could just do it under copyright law. You people are more lawyers than I am, so maybe you can tell me if I'm wrong. But anyway, so in principle that's a method, but again, it's a very limited method because it'll work if you're selling a small number of, you know, if you've got some very specialized program and you're selling 20 of it to 20 companies and maybe there are another 10 companies that would like to pirate it, something of that sort, well, those 20 companies may each have enough assets so that if they didn't let it go out, you could actually recover from them. But if you're selling, if you're expecting to sell 100,000 copies and you could have another 100,000 pirated, the odds are very high that the person who gives it to the pirate in that world is somebody who's very poor, he's judgment-proof, and you aren't going to be able to get anything out of it. So it's one thing you would think about. And then I also discuss the idea of one idea is the transparent cyberspace, which strikes me as not a very attractive idea, but it's one you could imagine where you have legal restrictions which basically allow somebody acting for the copyright owner to search the hard drives of everybody in order to find out if they got infringing stuff. Yeah?
I think that they kind of do stuff like that. Like, a lot of people download stuff from torrent sites, like this website or a thing called a program called BitTorrent.
Yep.
And I've gotten letters before from the internet company that says like your IP address was downloading from BitTorrent and like your downloading shows from HBO or something, and if you keep doing this where I've heard that they actually have seen people is like college campuses where they can get all the IP addresses and like track the kids down to their dorm rooms.
Yeah, I've got the same thing that I'm guilty of downloading for free. And I hadn't done it since college, and I got a new computer and I wanted a song, and ironically I couldn't buy the song on iTunes or Amazon. I couldn't find it anywhere but to download it illegally. And I came home, my boyfriend was like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm just downloading some music. And he's like, don't do that, because they'll link you up by your internet service provider and they'll find you.
Yeah, well, the RIAA has certainly made efforts, fairly highly publicized efforts, to sue people for downloading stuff. But they also get a lot of bad publicity doing that. And again, this is still fairly new. And there are ways, going through remailers and such and using anonymous browsers and anonymizers, in which one could protect oneself pretty well from those things. It's just that, again, it requires more expertise than people have when everything is new.
Just a quick comment on that. I used to work IT for a college campus and had to respond to all those takedown notices. And it seems to be not so much the fact that you downloaded it, but a lot of people will forget and leave it sitting there for people to download from. So when you start sharing it out, and they start seeing those packets fly by, then they get very... like you're saying, with the anonymous mailer or a proxy.
So there are probably ways. But it's an interesting question here, though. I'm curious as to how the class divides on the morality of copyright. That is, I want to set aside anybody who believes that something is moral or immoral because it's legal or illegal, because that's less interesting. But if you think about it, most of us presumably have this feeling that stealing people's things is wicked. All right, and there may be exceptions to that. You're allowed to steal the gun that's pointed at you or something. But normally, our sort of gut-level moral intuitions, I think, for most of us, is you're not supposed to steal people's stuff in your own if you do. And the question is, how many people have that intuition for intellectual property? If you say, suppose we were in a world with no copyright law, and somebody writes a book, and he announces to everybody, here's the deal, I will sell copies of this book to people, but I don't want them to make copies for anybody else without my permission. How many people feel as though you would be morally obliged to abide by that, in the same sense that you'd be morally obliged if somebody said, I'll let you use my shovel, but the condition is that you don't let him use the shovel because I'm afraid he'd break it or something. I think wouldn't most of us feel that in the real world case, there was some moral obligation to not use the shovel without permission? How many people feel that kind of obligation about intellectual property? Raise your hands if you do. Right? How many people don't? Because I found it intriguing. I noticed this especially among libertarians, because libertarians seem to divide between those people who see intellectual property as the most defensible form of property and those who see it as the least defensible. And the most defensible argument is to say, look, When you made that shovel, you had to get the iron from somewhere. You had to get the handle from somewhere, the wood from somewhere. You didn't really entirely yours. But somehow, it's partly yours. That all physical objects, the argument is, your moral claim to ownership is somewhat muddled because they used stuff that came from somewhere else. The tree grew on land. You didn't create the land. But intellectual property came entirely from your own head. In order to write that novel, you didn't have to use up anything anybody else in the world had. Therefore, your claim to ownership is absolutely pure in that case. That's the one side. On the other side, say, wait a minute, I own this book. It's my property. Why can't I do what I like with it, including copying it? So you've got, you've got some of the same thing with issues like abortion, but I find it intriguing in general when you find that people have sort of strong moral intuitions in opposite directions. Yep.
I think the distinction between the author and the guy with the shovel is that the guy with the shovel is giving you the shovel, or the author, it's coming from somewhere else. It's coming from the store. It's coming from some third party. It's not the guy. If someone lent you a book and said, hey, don't give it away, you wouldn't give it away.
Or you wouldn't give copies of it.
Yeah, exactly right. There's so many copies. It's secret. You read it and enjoy it.
Yes. That's interesting, because that's a different intuition, which is that we have much stronger moral intuitions with regard to human beings whose faces we're seeing than to anonymous institutions. So that, I guess the case which keeps striking me is all of the people who think that stealing a grocery cart from a grocery store is just fine. All right, it's a fairly valuable piece of property. I don't know what they cost, but I wouldn't be surprised if it cost $50 or $100 for one of those things. And yet, you know, you see people are trundling around. It doesn't occur to you, right? You see somebody, some presumably homeless person, trundling around with a Safeway cart full of stuff. And it just doesn't occur to you to call the cops. And yet, probably if they saw the same person go into someone's house and take a television out, you would call the cops. And again, it's sort of an odd feature of our intuitions. Yep.
Another difference, I think, between like loading out a shovel and downloading like a song on the internet is like, I kind of think of like songs on the internet as being like a public good, where it's like my using it and sharing it doesn't have any effect on anyone else using it. Whereas if Pat loaned me the shovel and I loaned it to my neighbor, if Pat wants it back, he can't.
But you could certainly imagine a case that is, you are right that you might have a consequentialist argument for a difference. But suppose that you didn't. Suppose we have the case where he lent you the shovel and he said, I don't want you to let anybody else use it. And he's not going to be back for several days. And someone wants to use it for a day. And you're reasonably certain that person won't break it. And if it does, you'll replace it or something. It seems to me you'll still feel some obligation not to loan it.
Yeah.
So even if it's a case where it's not imposing any cost, it seems to me you still have at least some moral intuition about it. And of course, the counter argument here doesn't impose cost is that the cost from the standpoint of the copyright owner is that he can't sell it if people can get it for free. And from his standpoint, that's certainly an important cost. Yeah?
So, the moral problem I have with copyright morally, I don't feel it's justified, but they're taking advantage of the fact that virtually they duplicate the same content that social media pops out, but the duplication aspect of it, and the fact that it's provided to so many people, if everybody was contributing like 0.25% of a cent to the owner could still make about a few $100,000, I think that'd be fine. But the fact that they have such a seemingly high price for it, that
I don't understand why. If you buy my book,
right,
I'm probably getting between 5% and 10% of the price.
Yeah.
So why is that an obscenely high price for all the effort I put into writing that book?
Well, I think I would feel better about because you also put the effort in once, right?
What?
You put the effort in once, right? And then after that, you're just making, you're like basically rent seeking off that.
I don't think we say rent seeking. If I made a shovel and then rented it out, assuming I've made it well so it's not breaking, once I made it once, I bore the cost once, and I'm getting a stream of income from it. Is that?
So if you have a shovel, and you can make it 1, 2, 10. If you have 4, it's going to be hundreds.
No, I made one shovel, but the shovel then gets used day after day after day.
Yeah, but that's fair. I mean, if we use that kind of morality in terms of intellectual property with electronic goods, it doesn't make so much sense because that one instance of intellectual property should not be worth as much. We should not analogize that to something like a shovel. Because the fact that there's a reason we value a shovel is because there's limited resources to do, versus the intellectual property on the electronic format. We shouldn't give the same kind of, you know, shovel is $10, a song should be $1 because, you know, it's a property. It should probably potentially be much, much smaller, but I mean, we sort of get blind, we don't see the fact that there is so much more.
It seems to me that it sounds as though underlying it, you've got some kind of a theory of just prices, and I'm not sure that I know of any good theory of just prices. And that presumably, if the price I charge for my book includes $1 to me as royalty, if you don't like that price, you don't buy the book. That's sort of how we usually decide what's a legitimate price for something, isn't it?
And that's true. And those are the time when you see a contributor like that, you probably would feel like, if you were getting like maybe 50 or 60% of, if you just self publication,
right,
I'm probably much more willing to give you whatever price you ask for, versus this is a long time to be honest.
All right. Anyway. But it's interesting because this is a case where sort of our moral intuitions really intersect with real legal issues. And where one of the things, in a sense, it's a whole lot easier to enforce a law that everybody believes in. And That's part of the problem with the war on drugs, of course, part of the reason it doesn't work. And when you have a law where a large part of the population doesn't believe in it, it becomes hard to enforce, and then it becomes interesting to try to think about why people do or don't believe in things. In any case, so then another solution is to get paid indirectly for your intellectual property, and there are lots of ways of doing that. One way, which goes back quite a ways, is you provide intellectual property that only works with particular hardware, and you sell the hardware. So that when long ago in the dawn of time, before most of you were born, Apple brought out this machine called a Macintosh, a lovely little machine, and it came with two programs. One was called McPaint and one was called McWrite, and they were free, and you could make copy, you could make all the copy you liked of that program. But of course it only ran on Macintosh computers. Therefore, it enhanced the value of the Mac, and therefore Apple could make its money by selling the hardware rather than the software. A different version of a somewhat related approach is if there is a way of identifying the individual computer, then I can sell you a program which is customized to your computer and will only run on your computer. You can make backups on that. But if you make a copy for a friend, it won't run because he has a different computer. So I'm not sure what the current status is. There certainly was talk at one point of Intel CPU chips having a built-in ID number in each one. And if you did that, then you could have the program sold to you check for your number. Now, obviously, this is a problem if you then, if that computer dies and you replace it, you might have to have contractual arrangements for updating, but it still provides a possible way. And the technical problem with it, of course, is that if people care enough, they may be able to go into the program and modify the part of it that checks for the serial number in a way such that it no longer does so or always reports yes or something. Or they might be able to modify their operating system so it lies about what the serial number is. So there are possible solutions, but it is another possible way you could do it. And then there are what I think of as the low-tech, sort of old-fashioned ways, which may be the best solution, and that is if you can't protect music, you give away the music and you sell concert tickets. If you can't protect books, you give away the book, but you sell your reputation, which you made by writing the book. So if you've written the book on some subject, now you are attractive as a consultant, as a public speaker, and so forth. And as I was commenting, I think before things started, Bill Buckley has got a book of his speeches, and at the beginning of it, he comments that the secret that authors don't tell you is that giving speeches pays better than writing books. And it's probably true. I've never done the calculation. I suppose I wouldn't be surprised if my revenue from speeches is larger than my royalty revenue in the average year. Now, it's a little hard to know how you do the comparison, because on the one hand, a book takes a lot more of my time and effort than giving a year's worth of speeches does. On the other hand, the book keeps giving that return. You know, well, usually it doesn't. That's, most books don't give you much royalty after the first year or two, unless you've been very lucky. But it may give you royalties for a long time. And similarly, if you think about, I was discussing earlier the idea of the academic world as sort of an open source style project, well, I don't have any desire at all to copyright my academic articles. I want to have as many people read them as possible. And one of the reasons is that having academic articles that lots of people read is one way you get tenure. It's one way you get better offers from another university or better treatment by your university. So that, in general, there are lots of ways in which you create intellectual property, give it away, and then get side benefits from that. And I think that's sort of one of the important areas for entrepreneurs in the next few decades is figuring out ingenious ways of doing that. I think I commented in an earlier class that what I would like to see Santa Clara doing is giving away a law school education online and finding ways of making money by doing so. And I bet you could do it. One way you could do it, incidentally, which not what I think that I would propose for us, is you could give away an education online and sell certification. So suppose, I've been reading my parents' autobiography, which I think I read in manuscript but not published, and one of the things they discuss is why the University of Chicago is a great university. And the answer is a man called Hutchins. There was Hutchins back in, I think, probably would have been in the late 20s maybe, became the dean of Yale Law School at the age of 27. He became the president of the University of Chicago at the age of 30. He was apparently a fairly impressive guy. And he was one of these people who was full of clever ideas, is very smart, rather arrogant, and wants to try sort of his ideas. A little bit like Gingrich, but I think a good deal saner than Gingrich is. But Gingrich has a bit of that feel, too. I mean, I think Gingrich is probably the most entertaining of the major political figures out there, even though I can see it might be a little hazardous to have him as president. But in any case, so Hutchins did a bunch of radical things in Chicago. One of the things was he decided that 4 years of high school was really more than was required. And so he made it possible for sufficiently bright high school sophomores to enroll in the University of Chicago as freshmen, to cut out 2 years. Something which he was apparently responsible for which I profited, was the University of Chicago Laboratory School, which is the elementary and high school. The high school is called U High, run by the university, reduced its length by a year. They combined 7th and 8th grade. That's part of the reason I got to go to college when I was 16. But he did a bunch of other things. One of the things he apparently did at some point, though I'm pretty sure it's not true now, was to set things up so that you could graduate from the college in any length of time, including a month, as long as you passed enough exams. So that basically, here are the courses whose credit you need for. You can get credit by taking the final exam and doing well on it. And that struck me as really a very neat idea. But it occurred to me that you could do that online profitably. So suppose you have a university and you provide all your courses for free online, and all you sell is taking exams. So anybody who wants to get your degree has got to pay you some appropriate sum of money for each exam they take. And when they've passed enough exams, you say, all right, you are as well qualified as the students who did it the usual way. We will stamp your ticket. We will certify that you are a graduate of online Santa Fe University. And that might indeed be a pretty profitable arrangement, because after all, giving exams, although it's a pain, is a fairly small part of the cost of running a law school. Yeah?
MIT is with that right now, with MITx. They're online.
And are they certifying it?
They're certifying. That's the thing.
Tell me about it.
So you go to MITx, it's the exact same course. Right now they only have one course on circuits. So it's the exact same course as like 10 years per thing. And they will basically, they're charging an administrative fee for the examination and everything. It's just the rigorous. And at completion, you get a certificate. Originally, they were saying that it will be not MIT, I mean, the name. It will be under MIT, but it will not have the MIT name for the word computer. But I think they went back on that, and they actually will have the MITx name on it.
But still, they're not giving you a degree. They're just giving you a certificate for one course.
But then the idea is they're going to continue doing this, and then they're going to have certifications. Like, you know, Stanford has a bunch of these graduate certificates.
Yes, yes.
Like a half master's, I guess.
Yes.
They want to do that for MIT, so they can have a certificate of some small half of, you know.
Yes. So they're moving in that direction. That's right. But that sort of is another example of how you make money giving things away. Right. And that, it seems to me, is one of the important projects of the next few decades.
Although I don't think they're going to make that much. I mean, they're charging administrative fees. Stanford makes money from their program, but I think MIT is more like, you know, they want to publicity.
Right. Yes. So all of these engineering are examples of possible solutions to that. All right, let me go on to the sort of the new stuff, which I've been thinking about, and hopefully you've been thinking about, and maybe you can add some stuff. And that is, if you think about sort of social networks very broadly defined. I don't want to limit it to Facebook, partly because I've spent almost no time on Facebook, although I do have a page there somewhere, and not that much time on Google+, though a little more, but I spent lots of time on Usenet. And I've done lots of email interactions. So if you think in general of the fact that the technology allows a whole lot of interaction without geographical limits, essentially instantaneous if you want it to be, that set of technologies, how does that change the world? And that seems to be interesting. And one question that occurred to me, to which I don't have an answer, but maybe one of you will, is what's the equivalent of spam? That is, email, before it existed, was obviously this wonderful, wonderful system. You can send messages to people at zero postage. It'll arrive in seconds, or maybe minutes if things are going slowly. You can send it to lots of people at once, so you can have mailing lists. Isn't this a great technology? And I don't remember ever saying, yeah, you know, it's a really great technology if you want to send the same message to 8 million people of whom 6 of them are interested in it. And the result of that, which I go through daily because at the moment I don't have adequate spam filtering, I've got some, is wading through the, I suppose, 400 or 500 messages I get each day, and I have efficient ways of going through them, but still it makes it a little harder to filter out the 5 ones that I really wanted to get. Did anybody know if anybody predicted that problem? Because it's a problem that comes from the virtues. All right, the virtues of email are that it's essentially costless, and that it's just as costless to send to lots of people as to one person. That made it a very, very useful technology. Also, a very, very inconvenient technology of its effect. Is there an equivalent of that? Is there Facebook spam? Anybody know? I don't.
A little bit.
How do you spam things in Facebook?
Well, just if like I don't know, maybe you're like a. Like, for instance, there's an article and I'm a friend of theirs on Facebook, and every week I'll get, like, a couple messages from them promoting, like, a night that they're having.
But you chose to be a friend of theirs.
Yeah.
And they couldn't make you a friend, right?
No, I have to.
Right. So that's not really the same thing as spam, right? That's like choosing to put yourself on a mailing list, which I also, yeah?
But, like Facebook, they want to do this.
They want to, but that doesn't mean that somebody, some individual firm or individual might say, yes, but I want to reach lots and lots. The more I reach the larger, the very small one. Yep.
I will actually get messages from people that I don't know that are trying to get me to like something, or people that they like a game or something, and it makes it so there's a reward system for them to spam everybody else with their notifications of, join my game, I want you to play Farmville, and I had to go in and disable
that. And their messages do not require that you friended them.
Right. Some of them are my friends, but sometimes I will get them to not friends. It's rare.
So what would limit me? Let's suppose I've got a novel as a Kindle. I want people to read it. I don't really care if I annoy 6 million people if only 100 of them will read my novel. What keeps me from sending messages to 6 million people, or Facebook's got more than 6 million? What makes it costly for me to send the same message, there's this wonderful novel you should read, to everybody on Facebook?
Facebook will eventually cancel. They'll start warning you.
So Facebook itself is restricting it. So, yeah.
Have an anonymous person, I mean, like a random person, give them a spam. There's a reputation with Facebook. But if you are a friend of mine and you're sending this to a spam, I'll block you. So there's a reputational incentive we can't do that.
Yes,
and to go up with what you think both of you were saying, my impression of how it's getting in there and working well is that by playing this other application, this game or whatever, you're granting that application some access to your account. One of those privacy things is to be able to post to your friend's account as you.
Yes.
So I think
that would be a possible problem.
Quickly get out of control. Yep. Also, really briefly, I read something today that for the first time in history, they're seeing actually a decrease in spam and an increase in just straight up malware, mal attacks. So, I don't know. That's
there are a bunch of sort of spam like things along the line. One of the things I notice, I do a regular search for people mentioning me to see if there's anything I ought to respond to, and sometimes what I see is something that has absolutely nothing to do with me. You've just taken a chunk from something referred to me or something I wrote or whatever and put it on, and it's pretty clear that what they're trying to do is to attract search engines. That they're trying to get a whole bunch of sort of random stuff. Maybe they've got some way of figuring out which pages are being looked at and say, well, if your page is being looked at, that means there's something on it that search engines find. If we copy stuff from you, they'll find us. We'll then get high eyeball counts. That will then be worth something in one form or another. So that's something of that general sort. I've wondered about possibilities for fraud. Suppose, for example, that you go up on Facebook and you create a very sympathetic character. I assume you're reasonably good at fiction. And so you invent a self who is somebody who has overcome great adversity, has behaved generously, has done all sorts of admirable things. And since sending many copies of a message is generally no harder than sending one copy, you make friends with lots of people who become impressed with what a wonderful person you are. And then you send out a message about how something terrible has just happened, you need money for an operation, or for your child's operation or something, and will your friends just send you 10 or 15 bucks? And, yep?
I've actually seen that in action really recently. There's a guy named Tommy Jordan who he did a YouTube video where he's scolding his daughter for a really attitudinal message that she wrote and posted on her Facebook. And so in as like a sort of immature, but I think something a lot of parents can relate to, in response to that, he shames her by reading the letter and saying, you know, that's really ungrateful. And here's your laptop sitting on the lawn, and he shoots it with a .45. And it went viral. Yep. So it got all this attention, and he has since then been sort of like, I don't want to plug anything because I think it might take off, you know. And he's posting now, like, he mentions something, and all of a sudden there's all this support because there's so much attention on it. And so I feel like the whole trending thing is actually giving people that leverage. So if you're willing to do it sort of through the back door like that.
So if you're willing to be clever about doing something, people will get you sort of an online reputation of being visible. It's like you know, film stars who can get money for endorsement. Not they have any expertise, but that they're...
Yeah, I mean, how much skill does it really take to shoot a laptop with a gun?
Well, but the question is, how much skill does it take to figure out that shooting a laptop with a gun will be something that will appeal to people? It takes a little bit more, maybe not a whole lot more, but a little bit more. But the it's not the same thing, but I think I mentioned before a description somebody I heard somebody give of how he got his Kindle to be briefly number one on Amazon by organizing, I think through Facebook or something similar, fans, and then getting all the fans to buy one copy each on the same hour of the same day. And since Amazon is heavily weighting its rankings to recent events, it shoots up to number one. Now other people are looking for the most popular things to look at it, and so more people read it, and so it doesn't stay number one, but it stays high if it's any good.
Have you heard of the shirt, the Three Wolves Moon shirt? They
no.
Sell the fake reviews on Amazon?
No.
Oh, somebody wrote a very funny review on Amazon of the Three Wolves Moon shirt, and it was
this
so
purports funny. To be a shirt or a book?
It's just a t-shirt.
Yes.
But it's this person who, just for fun,
yes.
writes a very charming review that got attention.
Yes.
And so sales of that particular shirt skyrocketed.
Even though there was no such shirt.
And thousands of... No, it's just
a shirt. Oh, I see.
It's just somebody was having a fun little
yeah.
time writing a message.
Yes.
And they completely mentioned it as a joke, but it gained a following, and so now there's thousands of reviews of this shirt, and it's like a really popular shirt now.
Oh.
And it's just, if it was a marketing stunt, it was a very clever one, but I don't think it was. I think it was just somebody who was being funny.
Yeah.
But something very small.
For another thing which is related to some of this, there's a Larry Niven short story called Flash Crowd. And the basic idea, now, it depends on a particular circumstance. In his story, there are transporter booths so that people can instantaneously go somewhere. But the basic idea is that the combination of transporter booths and media that everybody reads means the possibility that somebody says something gets attention and everybody goes to the same place. And you have a flash crowd, and then there are all sorts of chaos going on. And after a while, bad guys figure it out, and they create a flash crowd, and then... It's such so much chaos they can smash windows and steal stuff and things like that. And you can certainly imagine circumstances. I suppose the clearest case online would be if the flash crowd was virtual, in the sense as if you get a whole lot of attention to a particular website, the website shuts down because too many people are trying to access it. So it would be an accidental DDoS attack.
I feel like the news kind of does that, though, because, I mean, when I was working at Big Walk, we had coverage on CNN and our servers went down because... I mean, if you are on the news and you're like, hey, everybody, there's this cool Star Trek website, like, everybody's
yes.
going to go to that website, and it's going to, you know, nobody can handle that unexpectedly just shooting up like
yep.
that.
A more general point, which is getting more nearly political, and one which I think I mentioned it in the chapter, but which struck me when it happened, is the way in which this technology changes the balance between the center and the periphery. So the case I think I mentioned there was the Society for Creative Anachronism, which is the historical recreation group, where the people who were running it made some very, very unpopular decisions. I think they had stupidly hired a professional administrator from outside the hobby, and who thought he could get away with it because, after all, it's not an elected board of directors. The membership has no power, and the communication media traditionally are all through the center. You know, it's got a national magazine and stuff. And that isn't what happened, and part of the reason was that Usenet was big enough by then so that the people who didn't like what happened talked to each other. It rapidly became clear that for any argument that was offered, somebody in the hobby was a professional in that field who knew more about it than the people in the center who were arguing it and could rebut it. And the result was enormous pressure on the center to back down on some, at least, of what they were, not all, but a good deal of some of what they had done. And I can see other cases of that. When I was doing a Google search for ideas for this, I found a mention of something that happened in the Philippines in 2001, where the president was up for impeachment, and at least according to the story, his side in the legislature ruled to eliminate from the trial a bunch of evidence against him. And people who disapproved of this used, I think, Twitter or one of those systems to spread the word, and the message they said was basically a very short message to assemble wearing black at the following location. And, like, you know, in a while there were a million people there. And it was enough of a pressure so that the legislature backed down and the president ends up being impeached. And that's, assuming it's right, it's an interesting story in the sense that you can think of a lot of political contexts where the people at the center could normally get away with things, just because even though an individual who knew about it would disapprove, you're one individual, he's one individual, I've got other things to pay attention to, whereas you've got media such that the word spreads very quickly and very wide, now it's much easier to have large-scale responses. And that might be one of the things happening with the Arab Spring. That's, you know, I was hoping maybe some of you would have looked into some of it more than I have, but that certainly is a claim that's being made. So it might turn out, I'm not sure if it will, that over time the sort of what political arrangements are or are not stable is affected by this greater ability of dispersed people to coordinate and get together and exchange information and such. Another point that struck me, which is really not in a sense unrelated, except that it also affects politics, is the way in which the fact that these networks are non-geographical and have search capabilities means that you can pool people who have common interests. And one non-obvious feature of that might be, as long as the common interest isn't political, to make people more tolerant. Because what I'm thinking of is the context where you're part of a group of people who share an interest in medieval cooking. And it's obvious from interaction there that you're a really sensible guy who knows a whole lot about the subject, who is careful only to say things when he's got good... But you hold white political views? At which point maybe I started thinking, well, maybe my political views aren't quite so obvious as I thought. Maybe it isn't really true that everybody on the other side is an idiot, is an uneducated idiot, because here is somebody who I already know in a different context is not an uneducated idiot, who nonetheless is in favor of what I'm against. So you might, I'm not sure you will, but you might, y'all.
I think there's some truth to that, and I also think the problem with making people with common interests so accessible is then you have more of them, and then you can further go downstream and find somebody who is so same-minded as you. It's like somebody in, you know, Iceland may feel exactly the way you do about everyone, and if you have access to that person, you maybe don't have to compromise.
Yes. You're one step ahead of me. What I was going to say is that exactly the same process works in both directions. That on the one hand, my medieval cooking friends, who I will suppose probably truly have different political views, make me more tolerant. On the other hand, if I choose to spend my time online speaking only to libertarians, after a while it doesn't occur to me that anybody could doubt these perfectly obvious truths. I've just been having a long online argument with somebody, and I'm not sure I'm right, but I think what's going on is that he has really never associated with people who didn't share his political ideology in any serious sense. And therefore, he thinks it's just sort of a rhetorical trick when I ask him for evidence for claims he makes. Because everybody knows that's true. Well, you know, you're just laying, as it were. I think I'm not sure, but I think that's what's going on. So you can see that on the one hand, these networks make it easier to group on a non-political basis and thus make us more tolerant, but they also make it easier to group on a political basis and thus make us less tolerant. What the net effect is, I don't know, but I think it's interesting. Getting to something more nearly political, it did occur to me that one possible implication of this is for different forms of representative democracy. All right? Representative democracy is really the dominant political form in the modern world. And it is, I think, always, at least all the cases I can think of, it's geographical. All right? Who votes for a congressman is who lives in a certain area. There's no particular logic to that. So then there are two alternative ways of doing it I can imagine. One of them is that you still have a determined grouping, but it's determined in other ways. So that you could say, everybody, all the Harvard graduates, or all the college graduates, or all the men, or all the women, or all the men ages 30 to 40. You could think of all sorts of alternatives to geographical location, which could define the bodies in the electorate. So you could say, all right, who can best represent a man of 43? Why, a man of about 43. So therefore, the right way to do it is to make the congressman from the 43-year-olds, or from the male 43-year-olds, if you want. Let's see. Yeah, we've got enough congressmen that you could do it for every year of adult, for every gender, and still have a few left over for other things. So that would be one interesting way of doing it. Obviously, age is only one example. The more interesting way would be something more fluid. So my favorite idea, not because I think it would work better than anything else, because it's more elegant than the others, is you have a representative democracy where the representative is really a representative, meaning that you get to say which politician represents you. You can change anytime you like. And the politician casts a number of votes equal to the number of people he represents. So a really popular politician gets to cast 8 million votes. A not very popular one gets to cast 50,000. We add up those. Sounds like a pretty fair system to me. Now, there's a little bit of a problem, because as long as we're doing our congressional activity in the actual capital, there's a limited amount of room. So you say you only get a seat in Congress if you've got at least 1 million voters you represent. But if you have fewer than that, you can get together with a bunch of other people who in combination have 1 million, you have one seat, and you've got to decide who gets to sit in it when an issue that matters to me comes up, I sit there. When one that matters to you comes up, you sit there. And it's a really pretty system, both because it's much closer to a real representational system, because in our present system, of course, if you're a Republican in a congressional district that always goes 60% Democratic, you really aren't being represented by anybody. You know, your vote doesn't matter. Whereas in this one, everybody's vote matters at one vote. And furthermore, we can change in real time. You know, your representative, he voted what? I'm out of here, right? I'm going to switch to somebody else, to my second choice, because he votes the way I want. So that would be, I don't know if it'll work any better. I'm sort of a skeptic about there being a form of government that works well. But it seems to be more interesting. Yeah.
So in the corporation, that's what happens, right? You can pull your votes and have. But the thing is, in the division between all the way down to corporations, because there's money. Or, you know. But when it's in the politics, you don't want the majority to rule over the weak, right? But
the present system results not only can the majority rule over the weak, a minority can rule over the weak. It only takes, if you distribute them exactly right in a system with 500 representatives, it only takes a quarter of the population plus 251 people to have a majority of Congress. You just have to allocate them precisely right, so that every seat you lose by 100%, and every seat you win by 50% plus one vote. Is that more democratic? Is that a better system?
Well, at least the way we have it right now is that we elect a representative, and then we just, you know, we will trust them that they will be, when they go to Washington, those kind of looking for previous information that we're not.
If you trust your representative in my system, you just stick with him through hell and high water, even when you don't like how he votes. If you don't trust him, on the other hand, you don't.
Yeah.
And in our system, after all, every 2 years you get to vote against him if you decide you didn't like what he was doing. So you get to remove your trust just with a long interval. Mind you, can do it in 30 seconds. Anyway, but the real point I'm making is not that one system is better or worse. I think mine is prettier, as it were. But the real point I'm making is that technology enables possible forms of political organization that just were not an option in the past. And that strikes me as interesting for our purposes. Let me go to another issue, which is one which is, I guess, an increasingly live issue as we approach a presidential election, and that's the interaction between social networks and electoral politics. Because I gather that Obama made a considerable effort in the last election to use online stuff. Ron Paul clearly is doing a lot of online things, gets money that way, and organizes people that way. And so the question is, how do all of these systems play into our system of electoral politics with current institutions? And it seems to be the starting point is to see the sort of paradoxical nature of the whole system. That from the standpoint of a single voter, there is in fact no good reason for him to vote. And there is still less good reason for him to vote intelligently. And we have a whole mythos designed to cover that up. Right? There's no good reason for you to vote because in a presidential election, your vote has maybe one chance in 5 million of deciding the outcome, and it isn't worth paying very large costs for one chance in 5 million of maybe improving things or making worse if you guessed wrong. All right? Furthermore, even if it's worth voting because it's not much trouble, in order to vote intelligently, you have to spend a lot of time and effort investigating the candidates and the claims and what they've done and so forth. And it surely isn't worth doing that when you know you've got a tiny, tiny, tiny chance of, you know.
Isn't it kind of like your Bear in the Woods example, though?
I don't think so.
I view it as my vote might not be perfectly intelligent, but hopefully I can cancel out somebody else who's less intelligent.
But
or
if,
informed.
But as long as many people vote, your vote has a very close to zero probability of changing the outcome. Because, look, Florida was this amazingly close vote not long ago. What is amazingly close vote? A few hundred, a few thousand, that kind of scale. Not a few, not two votes, not three votes. Right? So, I don't think there is, as far as I know, there has never been a American election at the presidential or congressional level decided by one vote. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think I would have heard about it if there had been. So that means there's never been a vote when any single voter by himself would have made a difference if he had voted differently. In case two votes maybe would do it if he switched. But, and yet people vote. And same kind of problem arises with regard to political activity. That why should you man a phone or put up a sign or stuff of that sort? Now, it's not quite as strong an argument because you can say that might affect a bunch of votes, so maybe it would change it, but it's still pretty small. And how do you solve these problems? And with regard to voting, presumably partly the way you solve it is that the real payoff to voting is not changing the outcome. The real payoff is that you can tell people I'm a responsible citizen, or you can say, look, you can see that I'm a good guy because I voted for the person who you also think is the good guy and all our friends think is the good guy. I'm getting the various ways in which we have non-consequential, as it were, payoffs to the voting. If you think about politicking, it seems to me that there are really two mechanisms that are mostly used. One of them at the high level is professionals, that the people who are doing the sort of serious work for candidates are paid to do it. That's how they make their living. But at the lower level, the hordes of volunteers you need, I think a lot of what's going on is really tie-ins. That what's the payoff for working for a political candidate? Well, one of the other people working for the candidate might be a pretty girl who I could date. It might be an interesting guy who could become a friend of mine. As it happens, I think, though I am not certain, that I met or at least got involved with my first wife when we were campaigning for a hopeless candidate, a Republican trying to get elected to Congress in Chicago, in the University of Chicago district, that we were both supporting. I think he was a graduate student. It wasn't like it was a high-profile case. But you can see that a bunch of course, since she was my first wife, you could argue that's evidence against this method. I should have found a better way of finding somebody. But in any case, the basic point is that a lot of things people do, and I think not just politics, I think if you think about a lot of sort of volunteer activity of churches and other things, a good deal of the incentive is that the activity defines a group of people who have certain things in common, and what your real objective is not the activity, but to associate with people who share those values, characteristics, and so forth. So that's, in a sense, part of how you get people to work on your campaign. And then the effect of the social network is that you can have a much wider network of people you're interacting with. Now, one issue then becomes, yes, but how can I date her if it turns out she's on the other side of the country? So you would then might want, nowadays we're rich enough so you fly across the country, but a lot of people aren't. And so one thing you might try to do if you're organizing it is to group the people in your political social network geographically. Might be useful anyway because you want some of them to work on congressional campaigns. Easier if they're in the district. You want some of them to man a bunch of telephones in a building somewhere, so you figure out where people are geographically. But anyway, we're running out of time. But think about this stuff, because it's not in the book. I hadn't thought about it much then. But it seems to me the whole question of how these networks change the world is a fascinating question. Yes? Yes.
I was wondering, what if you I almost have given up on copyright law. So can I talk about, like,
yes. Issues should be mostly legal issues. That is, I'm not very rigid about that. But notice that the book is in a sense broader than the course, because the course is legal issues of the 21st century, and the book is not really about legal issues, although a lot of legal issues come into it. So you might want to think about, here is a business model, what legal problems does it raise, not just how do you make money doing this, fascinating as that question is. Yep. Right.